Recreation Roadshow. Are we all on the same, are we all here? How many people are new for the first time? Okay. New for the first time? Okay. I want to do just a quick review of what we've done and where we've been. Because I was looking in this Bible Roadshow of stories of creation. And what we're going to do today is the creation of discipleship in Matthew's Gospel. But it looks different. The creation of discipleship looks a little bit different when you've gone through the creation stories in Genesis and in Job. And what you find in Genesis and in Job is a lot of surprises. So I want to invoke, as I've invoked every day this week, why should we leave her out now? Let's give her a name, the 80-year-old Carmelite nun. Who should she be? Sister Grace. She's got to be a Mary Grace. We all have Mary in there somewhere. And it usually comes first. So Sister Mary Grace, let's give her a name. 80-year-old nun, Carmelite nun, who's in an enclosed order. That means, you know, she doesn't go out and help the poor. Her ministry is to pray and to read. And she prays on our behalf while the rest of us are out scurrying around in the world, like the little brown squirrels. There's somebody there anchoring us in prayer. And Sister Mary Frances, my friend, asked her, how do you read the same old text over and over and over again and have them give you new insight? And Sister Mary Grace said, I simply read the text until it surprises me. So I read the text until it surprises me. I want to give you that gift as we go back into our brown squirrel lives. Read scripture until it surprises you. Just take the time. It will reward. That time will reward you. So anyway, the surprises I got from these first very familiar stories of creation in Genesis is that in the beginning, God creates by inviting the creation out. God invites the creation out. God names and God blesses, all right? And we'll say a lot more about blessing. I'll say a lot more about blessing today because that is also echoed. We'll hear echoes of that blessing in Matthew's Gospel and in the creation of discipleship in Matthew's Gospel. Because Jesus calls his new creation out by blessing. And that's extraordinary. All right, and then the second surprise in the first story of creation is that God calls the creation out, invitation, naming, blessing, but God leads the creation by questions. And sometimes asking the right question is more important than coming up with an answer to the wrong question. So these are questions embedded in that Genesis account of creation, which really offer a kind of GPS system for the life of discipleship. And, you know, I keep repeating this. I want this to be kind of etched in our brains because these are great questions and these can continue to surprise us. Where are you? It's actually the question God asks the Satan in Job. Where have you been? Where are you? It's asking about physical location, but more than physical location. It's asking about emotional, spiritual, political, environmental, or as Larry Rasmussen keeps saying, planetary. You know, and I think that's really a rich, where are you? Where are we as a planet? Second question, who told you that you were naked? Who told you that? What are the kind of scripts that we live by and the scripts that we live out of? And where did they come from? And are they authentic? Are they leading us to live an authentic life? It's worth asking who wrote them. I mean, for a long time, I was living out of a script that I got from the University of Chicago, and I suddenly looked at the script and I thought, oh my God, I don't want to be that kind of teacher, professor, scholar. I'll let someone else do that, but I think my script may be a little bit different. It's scary discovering one that's not already made. But it's also kind of fun. Anyway, what have you done? The question God poses to Eve, and Eve then blames the serpent, and the serpent, you know, Adam blames Eve. This is Adam blaming Eve. Yes? And then Adam even blames God. And this is something Luther picked up on in his commentary on Genesis. Why are you angry? The question God asks Cain. When Cain is angry with his brother Abel, and beneath anger is always fear. And then finally, where is your brother? And this is William Blake's illustration of the curse of Cain. And Cain is heading into exile because Abel is dead and God has noticed his absence. And you see the dead brother and Adam and Eve looking, and Cain is horrified. And the earth is crying out. All right, and then, oh, these are kind of great questions. Where do these questions come from? John's Gospel, yeah. And John's Gospel, which we aren't going to get to in this Bible Roadshow, John's Gospel begins with a question. The first words out of Jesus' mouth in John's Gospel are, what are you looking for? What are you looking for? And again, it's a question of yearning. What does your heart desire? What do you long for? What are you yearning for? And then that same question of yearning and desire and love, it is a question of love, comes at the end of the gospel. And this is a question Jesus poses to Peter. Three times, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And I was in, all right, I was in St. Peter's in Rome. And in one of the side chapels at St. Peter's, and it could hardly be called a chapel, it's, you know, several churches could fit into this side chapel. But it's round, and on top, in Latin, are simply the words in Latin, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And you can, I just stood, and it was about 7:30 in the morning, nobody was there yet, the priests are getting ready for Mass, I just got my pilgrim credential stamped, and I stood in the center of the side chapel and just spun around, well, not spinning, but I walked around and saw these words again and again and again on the ceiling. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And I thought, that is really, that's the question, finally, at the end of the book of Job. Do you love me? And can you love what you cannot control? Can you love what you cannot protect? And that's the question Job is actually asking God. And it's the question God is actually asking Job. But more about that later. Anyway, the second thing that we looked at was breaking and remaking. One of the patterns of this story of the creation, one of the surprises we catch is that the new creation always comes out of the pieces of something else. Out of broken pieces. For there to be day, it has to be split apart from night. And for there to be anything at all, that smooth stone of matter has to be broken. So this is an imperfect replica of what you will find perfectly represented in the bathroom in the back of this building, okay? And that mosaic is made of broken shards of pottery that are intended for the landfill. And it's out of those pieces that somebody has created this image. So I invite you to go back there and take a look at it. It's kind of extraordinary. But these are pieces that have been broken and put together. Neely has pointed this out to me, that have been put together again in a new creation. And that's how it always begins. We never get the old creation back again. We always get something new. That's good news and that's bad news. I want my old life back again. But I know that old life is never coming back. But a new creation is coming. Not a diminishment, not a lesser than, but a new creation. The new creation always comes out of the broken pieces of something else. So don't remember anything else, but remember that. Okay. Then we get to Job. And Job is very much a conundrum. But the book of Job begins with questions. Begins with questions. God asks Satan, where have you been? Again, that question of where. And Satan says, from going up, walking to and fro in the earth and up and down in it. And the Satan in the book of Job is kind of less an incarnation of evil than kind of the divine police officer. And God then asks the Satan, have you considered my servant Job? And the Satan responds, does Job love God? Does Job fear God for nothing? Doesn't Job love you because you fenced him in and protected him? And you've given him all this great gear. Job has perfect gear. Curse Job, and he will... Oh, no, lay your hand on Job, and he will curse you. And God says, God allows the Satan to take control of the situation. God refuses to touch Job, but God allows the Satan to take control of the situation. And what is at stake here is really that question, does Job love God because God is God? Or does Job love God because God has given Job a lot of good gear? I mean, it's kind of a great question, right? And it's a fabulous question. It's an awful question. And that's what Job is having to wrestle with. And he's not given much help from his friends. At first they show up and they do what friends are supposed to do. They sit and mourn with Job and they share his state. They put ashes on their head. They tear their clothes. They sit around with him. It's the water truck. We need that. We didn't get much water last night, but how many people heard the storm? Pretty spectacular, yes? All right, so anyways, I'll talk over the water truck. So anyway, Job's friends hang out with him and share his situation, and they open not their mouths, and they sit with him in the dung heap for 7 days. And then they open their mouths. And they start talking about Job. What has he done? He must have some secret thing. This is his wife saying, curse God, I've done. And, you know, his friends are all saying, you must have done something. And Job is saying, look, I'm a righteous man. Why is this happening? I have been righteous. I have fulfilled all the sacrifices. I have. And Job never surrenders his agency. And Job says in the midst of his lamentation, I know that in my flesh I shall see God. I know. And Job never quite becomes a victim. He always says, I want an answer, I want an answer, I want to see God. And lo and behold, Job does see God. It's not the God he thought he would see. I think Job kind of thinks God is fair. Job thinks God is the great rewarder of righteous behavior. But God is... You know, in a way, God is love. And the God who speaks to Job out of the whirlwind and speaks to Job in a series of questions, who are you that darkens counsel with words? Were you there when I created the heavens? Were you there? Have you seen where the wild goats leap? All these questions. And at the end, Job says to God, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. And Job, in his grief, in his suffering, Job in the loss of his property and his children and his servants, Job in a skin disease which marginalizes him and pushes to the outskirts of civilization, Job is on the edges of everything. And what I think God is telling him from the whirlwind is that, you got a lot of company. Look at all this great stuff that I created, all these wonderful wild creatures who don't stay where they're supposed to stay and who don't do what they're supposed to do and who are unpredictable and untamable and ungovernable and useless, Job, like you think you are. I love these creatures, and I love you, all right? And I love you even though I can't control you, even though I can't protect you. I love you. And, you know, hang out with the wild ass for a while. Or the Leviathan, or the behemoth. There are a lot of creatures out there whose only purpose is beauty. And I think that's the question. So Job is like, wow, he's hard. And I think, let me just roll through these. Job's world and God's world are very different. Job wants a world with no surprises. He wants everything to be predictable. And he's got a God who's full of surprises. Job wants a world where God owes the righteous a good time. And he's got a God who is interested in sheer delight. He's actually got a God who has stepped back and let free choice and natural necessity govern. That's the only way we have free choice, is if God is not a puppet maker. Job wants a God, well, I mean, Satan is posing the question, does Job love God for what God can do for him? Or does Job love God because God is God? And when God reveals God's self to Job, Job just is overwhelmed. Now my eye sees you. It's extraordinary. So Annie Dillard, the creature loves pizzazz. Because I think, you know, when you read the divine speeches in 39 to 41, it's clear that God is delighted in all these crazy creatures. And God is also delighted in Job. So here are the questions I think Job leaves us with. And these are questions every parent knows. These are questions every child knows. Can you love what you cannot control? And can you love what you cannot protect? I don't know. I want to say the answer to that question is yes. You're saying you're coming up with something. But it's a great question. And I think for Job, what did it cost Job to have more children? Who might be taken away from him the way his first children were. What did it cost Job to have more children and love them the way he loved his first children? Knowing that he couldn't control them, and worse, he couldn't protect them. You know, do you love a little bit less so it won't need to hurt so much? You know? What do you think? It's a temptation. Aristotle. Let's get Aristotle in to break the madness. Aristotle says, you know, parents always love their children more than their children love back. Oh, my God. I didn't think Aristotle was that wise. I knew he was smart. But, but Aristotle is saying something here about love. And what Aristotle should have said is, and do we love them less because that might be the case? No. But this is a question that needs to be asked. Can we love what we cannot control? Can we love what we cannot protect? Can we love what may not give back to us what we put in? And it's a question we want to answer yes to, but it's a question we also want God to answer yes to, right? Does God love us even though we're not going to be able to love God back? Even though we're not going to be able to be governed or be tamed or be good? Is God going to love us? Job has daughters. I think Job's answer to that is, well, I'm going to give it a good shot. You know? And so he has three beautiful daughters. He doesn't give them servants. He names them these wild and crazy names: Jemima, which means dove; Keziah, which is kind of a fragrance, possibly cinnamon, which we all put, or many of us put, on our quinoa yesterday. He has this wonderful Karen Hapak, which was the horn of a goat which contained eyeliner. It's kind of great names for girls. Better than Marty. But, you know, so here's this, and I think there's delight. Job caught the delight thing. And you sense in that delight that Job is going to give it a good shot, his best shot in loving. All right, so here's the question. Well, does Job live happily ever after? I don't know, you know. That second ending about all the good stuff, as somebody pointed out yesterday, that might have been a tack on. And it could have ended with Job saying, "Now my eye sees you." And what would we think of that? But we don't know, and we don't know that Job's skin disease was healed. We don't know that. We don't know that Job lived happily ever after. I hope Job loved happily ever after. That's what I really hope. Because I think that would be really good. So I wanna now ask the question, God is love. This is asserted again and again in John's gospel, which we're not gonna get to. But do we really want God to be love? Especially the way it's been laid out. A love that may not be able to protect us the way we think we need to be protected. A love that may not, or do we want God to be fair? As in, why do the wicked prosper? I think it's really a hard question. I didn't realize until last night how radical that saying is. God is love. God is going to be that kind of reckless generosity. God is going to be that kind of lover of delight. God is going to be, I will love you even though I can't control you. I will love you even though I can't protect you. I will love you to the bitter end. And I think what, you know, we can't make a theology out of Job, as Ralph Gardner keeps reminding me. But you know what? We can add the New Testament to it, which is where I want to go today. Because that gives us a God who loved us enough to become Job in our midst. You know? Isn't that what Jesus is doing? Is taking on that kind of suffering just so God knows what it's like to be one of us. But I don't know. It's a pretty hard message. But it's the message we need. It's the only message I think I want most days. Do you see where we're going? All right. Do we want a God of love? Let's not vote on it. Let's see how we get there. Let's see what the God who becomes Job for us and with us. Let's see what that God does. And let's see if that God has anything to say to us. Okay, so are we ready for Matthew now? Are there any questions? Have we all been on the same bus? I mean, I keep thinking and thinking and thinking about this stuff because you all keep talking and talking and talking. And asking more questions, and I'm thinking, okay, if I take the question seriously, like I'm telling people in the Bible study, I gotta really live these questions, the questions you're asking, right? So any other questions that I can't answer? Or for the good of the whole, I think this is the only, I want to try to live by this stuff. This is really needy. Any questions?
If you say God is love, and then you say, well, is he really that?
Or she?
What's the opposite? You. Not just hate.
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no. I think the opposite is far worse than hate.
Yeah.
You know, I think the opposite is that hate is an easy opposite.
Uh-huh. Right.
I think the hard opposite is God fair? The way we think God should be fair? Why do the wicked prosper?
Yeah.
You know, is God in control? I mean, I want God to be in control when things are going poorly. I don't care about God being in control when things are going well. I want to take credit. Do you see what I mean? I think this is really a hard question. I think the alternative to God is love are questions like, is God a judge of the unrighteous? Because, and you know, that's a tough one because I've been unrighteous too. probably most of the time. You know, so we always want God to judge everybody else,
right?
But not us.
Yeah.
So I think these are the really hard questions. Is God love? Do you think God loves the Satan? Ooh.
Yeah.
That's you. That was on the tip of your tongue,
yeah,
wasn't it?
I mean, you know, here's Satan walking around the creation and
up and down in the earth.
And God still lets him walk around. So.
I would like the Satan to be on a donkey, quite frankly. But this is, you know, I think in Job's gospel, the Satan is the chief accounts officer, adding things up. And, you know, and he clearly says, well, of course Job loves you. Look at all the good stuff you've done for him. You take away, like you were doing yesterday, take 3 and 5 off that list. Take the top and the bottom things off the list. List the things you love that make life worth living, and now edit that list. And now take the things that, take 2 things off. And now take the top thing and the bottom thing, because we have no control. So, you know, what happens when the list gets edited down? Are we going to love God as much? Is God going to love me when... You know, I think these are really tough questions. Only a God of love can help us. That is the best and hardest news we've got. But, you know, here's the thing I realize about God. And, you know, this is... Did you decide what the seraphim's wing covers yet? You can ask her about that. I love it. That's really great. That's going in the book. God does what he says, or what Paul says Jesus does, which is God pours God's self out of creation so that it has free will, which is good news and bad news. God is not then the controller or puppet master or mother and father of creation. We're adults. And in Philippians, this is how Paul says it, and Paul's, you know, kind of, this is Paul's pasting in a popular rock song of the day. Who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself. This is kind of God pouring God's self out of creation so that it will have some life of its own. And that's good news because we have a life of our own. And it's bad news because we have a life of our own. So I don't know, you know, that's what we get. That's what we get, it's hard. But I want nothing less. Nothing less.
I just keep thinking, and I guess the only way I can kind of relate to this is as a mom, if I saw love as only always protecting my son and making sure he never got hurt or, you know, emotionally or physically, and if I just did everything I could to always serve him and make, it wouldn't help him in the end. When
no.
He left, he wouldn't know how to take care of himself when
right.
He left the house as an adult. And so would that really have been loving him to help make him an independent, self-sufficient human being?
Right. I think that's a good analogy, and I'm trying to pull all of that experience in. I've never been a mom.
Yeah.
But I watch moms. I have one. And you know, I know that ache from her side. And she didn't love us less because we weren't the kinds of kids that she hoped we'd be.
Yeah,
kids
mom.
Never are, you know?
Love
we turned out different. Not worse, not better.
Yeah.
So you want a love that will allow you to be.
Yeah,
and,
love, let you make mistakes.
Yeah,
and
let
then
make
you
mistakes.
Have those pieces that you create.
Yeah. I think parenting is a really good metaphor, but not only for this kind of stuff. And that kind of, you know, imagine God being a really great parent, although he didn't do too well with Cain and Abel, or she. You shouldn't show favoritism, but, you know, that was silly, you know, that's when we let these stories just be stories. Let's go to Matthew, because I do wanna unpack Matthew's story of creation. And do you all have access to the little cheat sheets? Because I'm gonna make you work. I'm gonna make you work for these insights here. Do you all have access to the?
No.
Okay, great. Here we go. The in Matthew's, do you guys have them up here? Okay, so like let's breathe, and then I wanna notice a couple of things. You know how you pay attention to the first words out of somebody's mouth? They kind of etch character. They kind of give you a little secret cue or clue as to who this person might be, the first words out of their mouth. So the first words out of Jesus' mouth, in John's Gospel are, what are you looking for? Oh man. What do you seek? What do you desire? Fabulous. The first words out of Jesus' mouth in John's Gospel are words of blessing. This is the first sermon in Jesus' public ministry, the Beatitudes. And
Matthew.
I'm on Matthew now. I'm tripping around in Gospels here. But now let's stay with Matthew. First words out of Jesus' mouth in his public ministry. Okay, so this is Jesus in public. This is his first call interview. The public sermon at your church. And this is his sermon in the pulpit. And the first words, these are the first words out of his mouth. And he's called, you know, there's evidence that he's called the 12 beforehand. But this is kind of, he's calling a larger pool in this sermon. And this is the first way he does it. So what I want to do is I want to recruit you to help me read this, to listen to this. So listen to this as we're all reading it. And all of you, I want you to read that. I want you to all come in on the first word of Jesus' first sermon, which is the word what?
Blessed.
All right, so we'll all say that word, and then I'll read the rest, if that's okay.
Sure.
I'll give you a chance a little later on to do more reading. But let's just listen to this when we all read that first word. So it's kind of, I've bolded it on this text. Let's all read that word, okay? So ready?
Blessed
are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Blessed
are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted.
Blessed
are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth.
Blessed
are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled.
Blessed
are the merciful, for they will receive mercy.
Blessed
are the pure in heart, for they shall see God.
Blessed
are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God.
Blessed
are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Blessed
are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. Not bad for a first sermon. I think he stole it all from his mom. Because this is the Magnificat in, you know, just different guys. And of course the Magnificat was stolen from Hannah's song in 1 Samuel. But let's just, they didn't have ancient footnoting practices, were somewhat imperfect. What do you hear? What do you hear in that when it's read that way? What do you hear? Love?
And we're taking care of. I think we're taking care of.
We're taking care of. That the word blessed, it isn't just the word, it kind of does something, doesn't it? You know, when somebody says, blessed are you, you know, you feel something is happening, right? And today, all right, I'll do the assignment. Today I want you to tell someone how they have blessed you, and I want you to find someone and bless that person. I don't care how you do it. Just do it. Yeah.
Would you unpack that word a little bit more, the meaning of it?
What puzzles you about it? Now that
I say bless you, I'm not sure. It can mean a lot of things.
Right.
So I'm wondering what it means in this context.
Let me unpack that a little bit. Is it okay to go there now? Or is there anybody else who wants to listen to something else in these texts? Any other reactions to these?
Well, I hear broken pieces.
You hear broken pieces? Because what is being blessed, yes? These are broken people, yes? In front of Jesus. And he is blessing them. And it's out of these broken pieces a new creation is going to happen, yes? It's not the 18. But it's out of these pieces that a new crowd of disciples is going to be built. Yeah.
I love what someone said in an earlier session about how we use the word blessed as a kind of a reward from God for possessions and mm-hmm. good things that happen to us, and that we misuse the word blessed.
Yeah. It's interesting. Let's remember that, because that's going to come up again and again. This doesn't look like a Mercedes, you know? It doesn't look like hordes of servants and cattle and camels like Job had. This looks like Job on the dung heap, right? Yeah.
One of the things that I wonder about the word blessed is in the text, is it the same word that we use when we bless God in God's name? Is it the same exact word as is used when we say, blessed are you, O God, creator of the universe?
Thank you.
Is it the same?
This is a Greek, and that would be a Hebrew. They are the same meaning. Because what blessing does here is call. And that's a way of getting God's attention. It's the way God calls us. God calls us by blessing. We see this in the Psalms, especially that word blessed as a way of calling the people of God together. And it's a way that we call God. Blessed are you, O Lord, our God, King of the universe. Blessed. And it's kind of a way, I want to hear it as a word of calling. Because it's a way of getting God's attention, it's the way God gets our attention. So we are called by blessing. And I think, especially in this opening sermon of Jesus, he is calling the disciples out by blessing them. And a Jewish audience would have heard that immediately as a wake-up call. Oh my gosh, pay attention, we're being called out, we're being called to attention, we're being called by this word of blessing. And that is fascinating, because I think we expect, especially as disciples, to be called by command, you know? I grew up in Baltimore, in a row house in Baltimore, and I live next to a family of 6 kids, Roman Catholic family, you know, and they're all stuffed into this tiny little house. And at 6 o'clock every evening, Mrs. Cadigan would open the back door and she'd go, come and get it! And Cadigan kids from every corner of the neighborhood would come rushing to dinner, because they knew if they, first come, first serve. And she was calling them by command. And I think we think God is going to call us also by command. Like, go and do this, go and be that. And God calls us by blessing. And I think sometimes we're listening so hard for that command that we miss the blessings. All right? So Jesus is calling these disciples by blessing. And I think that's really important. Let me say 3 things about biblical blessings. That's a nice image, isn't it? I should footnote that. Anyway, God begins with blessing. We've seen that in the creation accounts. Invitation, naming, blessing. So God creates by blessing, just as Jesus is creating his band of disciples by blessing. The second thing is blessings can't be revoked. They can't be taken away. We see that in the blessing of Jacob and Esau. Isaac blessed Jacob instead of Esau, and he can't say, oh, wait, come back, you guys. We're going to do this over again. Miracles can be redone, right? You know, Jesus redoes the miracle of the guy who sees, but he sees trees. They look like trees walking, right? Jesus redoes that miracle, and it turns out okay. But blessings cannot be revoked. So even in creation, the blessings of creation are not revoked by the fall. They cannot be taken away. Once you bless something, that blessing sticks. That ought to be good news for every parent who's baptized a child who is no longer going to church. But, you know, those blessings really stick. They have that really sticky character. And blessings also leak. Blessing is never, and this is the leaky character of God, the generous character of God. Blessings are not reciprocal. I bless you, you bless me. No, I bless you. You're supposed to bless all the nations of the world. Abraham is blessed to be a blessing to all the nations. What does Elizabeth say to Mary when she sees her pregnant niece on her doorstep and she herself is pregnant? She says, blessed are you among women. That's got to be good news to a pregnant teenager, right? You know, what your aunt says to you when you show up on her door pregnant, and she says, blessed are you among women. And she can't stop with Mary. And blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus. So the blessing leaks. Blessings are like that. They feed on each other and they leak. And we've got to hear, once we get that rhythm of blessing down, we've got to hear the echoes of it throughout Scripture. It's extraordinary. But I think it's interesting. Abraham is blessed to be a blessing to all nations. Wow. All right, let's read this again, okay? And this time, we're going to divide the room in half, like right here. Okay? Mark and Dorothy, you can go that way. You guys can go this way. You'll be all this way, okay? And I want this side of the room to start off and read that first part out to the margins. And then you guys read what's indented. Is that okay? We can do that. So you start and then you read the indented part. Right? Because there's another way in which these blessings work. Okay?
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven.
Okay, great. Thank you. What do you hear in that reading of the Beatitudes? This is kind of a second map of this landscape of blessing. What do you hear when that's laid out like that? Yeah?
I hear blessing is God's promising to help them become what God intends. So the situation is laid out in the first reading, and then what God does really is to help them. The words counteract that, but
yeah,
this is what God will do for you. This
yeah
is who you will become because God is present with you.
Yeah. That's very good, and you use the word that Bonhoeffer and Luther would use, that this is call and promise,
yeah,
or blessing and promise. And with every blessing, a specific promise is made. Anything else anybody here on that? Every promise, each of those promises is very specific to the blessing at hand, to the condition of the person who's being blessed. It's not a generic promise. It's a very specific promise. And it's a promise that the poor in spirit need. They need the kingdom of heaven. Those who mourn need to be comforted.
Marty, I hear that it's not just a static promise, like, blessed are those who mourn in that state, but more movement, for they shall be.
They shall be.
Comforted. That, you know, there is hope that God is active in this.
Well, and it's interesting because, as you pointed out, blessing does something to you. And, you know, what it does to you is in a way begin the promise of blessing. The promise begins with that. When we say, I love you, it kind of is more than words. It delivers the goods. When we say in a marriage vow or a partnering ceremony or a blessing ceremony, I promise that I will love you. From this day forward, forevermore, till death do us part. That's the traditional language. But, you know, that begins the delivery of the promise right there. And in a way, the fascinating thing, the promise is standing in their midst, right? That Jesus himself is the promise. And we'll see that by the end of Matthew's gospel, Jesus has taken all of these conditions into his own body. Like Job. And the disciples are the ones who bless him. Right? I mean, it's amazing when you look at the Jesus in this gospel. Jesus has taken all of this suffering, mourning, meekness, hunger and thirst for righteousness into his own flesh, and the disciples have blessed him. It's pretty extraordinary. So the promise is in their midst. And the promise is already in the process of delivering on the promise. It's extraordinary. So that I want to... can I say a word, bless you? So these guys are called and promised. Let me ask for one more reading of this, okay? And we're going to keep the divisions up here. Only you guys over here, I want you to read the first four Beatitudes, both the blessing and the promise. And you guys read the last four Beatitudes, which are separated. And then we'll all read the final Beatitude, which is, blessed are you, right? So let's look at these texts that way. And why don't you guys then begin?
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven.
Okay. What do you, I've given away a little bit of what's going on here, but what do you hear in that? What do you hear in that, now that we've read it that way?
But the second half, the second four, is sort of, I guess a little bit more powerful, or being able to make choices about how to act, and the first four are sort of condition of things that happen to them that isn't really a choice for them.
Mm-hmm. Only if you switch the persecuted and the hunger into the righteousness, then it would be nice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Say that again.
Switch.
Well, one is active and one is passive, basically.
Yeah.
Or one is about who you are and the other is about having things done to you, but only if you switch hunger and thirst for righteousness with persecuted for righteousness. So
yeah.
That would be really nice.
Well, I think those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, it's a passive situation, right, in some ways. And then the people who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, I read as they've been trying to help those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. I think that's the way, I think that's the way the text reads here. But you're right in that the first quatrain are people who are kind of victims of the world's ways. Stuff has happened to them that they're suffering. They're suffering, they're living in an accusative case. And then, and I want to hold to the passage you pointed out, the people who are in the second quatrain, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, and those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, let's hold on to that for a minute. But the people in that second quatrain are those who help them. All right?
Who what?
Who help them.
Help.
Yeah. So we've got in that first quatrain the victims of the world's ways, and in that second quatrain, those who help them. And then I want to come back to your point up here. This is kind of like Jesus' version of the joke. There are two kinds of people in the world, right?
Yeah.
You know? Only it's not a joke. There are two kinds of people in the world, the victims of the world's ways and those who help them. And then I think, taking your point, the victims of the world, those who help the victims of the world's ways will themselves be persecuted. So in a way, Jesus is saying, you know, there's really only one kind of people in the world, and we call them disciples. The victims of the world's ways and those who help them, it's all going to involve suffering. So he's saying, are you on this bus? I'm blessing you for the journey ahead. And I think it's extraordinary. I take heart, or I take evidence in that shift from third person plural, blessed are those, to second person plural, blessed are you. Suddenly, it's not about somebody else. We're there. You know, we're all on this bus. And there are victims of the world's ways. There are those who help them. Those who help them are going to be persecuted, are going to become then the victims of the world's ways. It's an endless cycle. I bless you for the journey. Yours is the kingdom of heaven. And scholars, I'm not just making this up, scholars see a difference between that first and second quatrain and see that this is the way Matthew's laying out that journey of discipleship. And we're blessed to be a part of it, no matter where we are, because in the end, we are all one. I want to move to the last sermon in Jesus' public ministry, because we see here a kind of remarkable reversal. And that's on the back of your sheet. And let's take a look at that. I want to read that really quickly. But as I'll read this, but as I read it, listen to echoes. I'm going to ask where you hear echoes of Jesus' first sermon in his last sermon. And what's changed. Okay? So, and again, this is the last sermon in his public ministry, and it comes as a kind of parable. And in my Bible, it says at the top of the page, The Great Judgment. But I have another title for it. Anyway, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, Come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer him in turn, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you? And the king will answer them, Truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me. Then he will say to those at his left hand, You that are accursed, depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not welcome me. Naked and you did not give me clothing. Sick and in prison and you did not visit me. Then they will also answer, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? Then he will answer them, Truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Okay. Echoes of the first sermon. I mean, people say you've only got one good sermon in you. I mean, it goes for Jesus too, and he stole it from his mom. So, what do you hear? Echoes of the first sermon. Or anything really that you hear.
Two kinds of people.
Sheep and goats. Right hand, left hand. What else? They don't get a chance to get persecuted anymore. Oh, they're going to get persecuted for sure. Yeah.
That Jesus... It's interesting that the sheep and the goats are all addressed to the people who... how they treat the poor and the meek in the morning and all that. So the poor and the meek in the morning aren't among the sheep and the goats being separated. Mm-hmm. It sounds like they're already... in. Like, that's
interesting.
Jesus kind of has them, under his wings or whatever. He's like, so how did you treat these?
Yeah.
So they're not even...
They're not part of the discussion
so
at all.
So the whole sheep and, Hoofus and Gallant thing is like, the second quatrain folks, and how did you do?
How did you deal with the least of these? How did you deal with those who are hungry, those who are thirsty, those who are poor? Because they're the same conditions, in a way. Yeah.
This seems really Job-like. You know, we're back to all these people that are being persecuted and suffering and terrible things are happening, but yet this becomes like opportunity in the context of the story.
Mm-hmm. Opportunity for what?
Opportunity for us to be blessed, be in response.
Yeah. Who's doing the blessing here? Let's push that out a little bit. Who's doing the blessing here? You that are blessed by my Father, yes. But the people who have fed the hungry, visited those in prison, they have now done the blessing. And that blessing has happened to the king because the king has taken on all of these oppressions or all of this stuff into his own body. Even as you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. So in a way, this is back to my point. Jesus has become that suffering of Job. And the people who have blessed him were the people whom he blessed at the beginning of the gospel. So the blessed have become a blessing. And the one who blessed has become the ones who is in need of blessing. And the disciples have done it. I just want to close with, and I'm sorry I didn't leave more time for questions, but I want to close with, the title of this little parable at the top of my gospel is The Great Surprise. Because against the template of all that we've done this week, what I capture is the surprise of the disciples who sort of go, man, when did we see you? We didn't know it was you. And it's Jesus who has taken that suffering into his body. And the disciples now have done the blessing. And he has become the one who is blessed. So I'll stick around for a little while and answer questions. It's 10 o'clock. Thank you. Thanks for your attention. Go and bless.